My gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have Alejandro Rojas coming up in just a minute with UFO updates. Our guest today, we have Robert Powell, and we're going to be talking about the SCU. It's a new organization started, and we're going to be talking about the USS Nimitz 2004 UFO case, the Tic Tac case, it's otherwise known as. And just a couple of things. If you support the show, I want to thank you very much. Anyone can support the show, whether you're on YouTube or wherever you are. All you have to do is go to podcastufo.com, and there's right on the top menu bar. And that way you get access to the full two-hour shows, archives. And also, I do want to give a shout-out to the people at the Dark Matter Digital Network, because I am shocked at how many people listen to the show over there. So hello, everyone. And so that show is on Thursdays. It's a full show. You can listen to it as a podcast Thursdays, and that's 10 to midnight on the Dark Matter Digital Network. So if you can't support the show and you want to listen for free, you can do it that way. You can also watch on YouTube. And we're live on YouTube every Wednesday night at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that is it for me. Hello, Alejandro.
Hello.
How are you? You were stuck in traffic. I just had to put that announcement up. But you made it.
Yeah, I did make it. So I'm so sorry for being tardy. I always am such a pain. But
not at all. Not
your
at all.
Patience is appreciated.
Not at all. And I am excited. I'm going to be helping out at the UFO Congress. I'm pretty excited about that.
Yes, I'm excited too.
Yeah. So it'll be.
Yeah.
I just hope I don't, you know, how sometimes it's a little tricky here when I'm doing the show live. I just hope I don't cause any glitches there that we have to talk about.
The Congress is going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be cool. You'll be backstage. You'll be working cameras. You know, if people see you, they can go high five you.
Yeah.
And say hello. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of cool speakers. And, you know, one of the speakers we're going to have is, I don't know, is Robert? Yeah, he's still on. It's a friend of Robert's, or at least they're acquainted. And I talk with Robert a lot. Robert Powell is awesome. You've got a great guest for tonight. And I believe he's worked with Alan Holt, who I believe someone that Robert has worked with him quite a bit, because he's a science type person, a NASA person, and he helped out with MUFON for quite a while, as did Robert. And hopefully Alan can maybe get on board with this new project that I've been working with Robert with as well, the SCU, which is really exciting. And I think there's a lot of really cool stuff that's going to come from that. So, yeah, the Congress is going to be a lot of fun. Oh, that's what I was saying. This Alan Holt guy, he's going to be speaking. So he worked for something like 30 to 50 years for NASA, long, long, long time. And but he's really into UFOs, so he's going to be talking about that interest and his research into UFOs, that finally, now that he's retired, he feels more comfortable to come out and speak about.
Oh, wow. That's great. And so we're just having a little bit of a glitch, Alejandro. The whole show seems to be frozen on YouTube. All right. Well, let's keep going. And
showing up on.
Yeah. You
all
can
right.
See you.
Okay. Here we go.
All right. Well, let's keep going. And
I think I felt like I just already said that.
Yeah. So people can check out the website, ufocongress.com, and you'll see a lot more. You know, the Martin Willis, and we're not going to really announce that or make a press release about it, because it's kind of a behind-the-scenes thing, but I know that your listening audience will probably be very excited about that.
Well, that's good. Yeah. All right. Excellent. And what is going on in the UFO world?
Yeah, so some interesting things going on that I was going to talk about here. One of them is, I found this interesting. So Philip Mantle, you've had him on your show, UK researcher. He occasionally writes for openminds.tv, and he recently wrote an article about these China Lake UFO photos.
Right.
Not sure if you've seen them. They're kind of like throwback photos. They're similar to the types of photos we saw in like the 50s and 60s. People like, what's his name, David Fry, something like that. His last name was Fry. There was this guy at White Sands who used to take pictures that were kind of crazy like this. But there are, and that's who this potential hoaxer could be trying to emulate here, is these old-time hoax photos. So this photo is one of those too-good-to-be-true type of photos. This person posted a few with Heather Wade, and you were just talking about the Dark Matter Network.
Yep.
So this person said, I've got these crazy photos I've been sitting on for 10 years. What do you think? And uploaded those, and Heather Wade kind of sent those out to people. And they've been very controversial. They're supposedly at the China Lake, kind of dry lake testing bed, top secret kind of area in California. And there's a helicopter in the background in one or two of the photos. And this strange, I don't even know how to describe, kind of gumdrops, like two gumdrops put together with a large end stuck together, kind of shaped object, silver. It's hard to tell how big it is. So really interesting photos. I'm, of course, always skeptical right off the bat, for better or worse. I apologize if that's frustrating. But, you know, we want to be very rigorous about how we look at these things and put them under the paces to make sure they're genuine. What Philip did was talk to a bunch of researchers. He was able to get a hold with the alleged witness and then put together a story about this. And what he found was kind of interesting. So researchers such as Bruce McAbee, who worked for the Navy as an optical physicist, he at first thought they were silly, but then he's kind of on the fence. He's not so sure about it. And that I find very interesting, because I thought Bruce would very quickly debunk the whole things. Mm-hmm. And but there are some Brazilian researchers that bring up some good points, and they believe there to be hoaxes. And I couldn't find the exact quote because I wanted to put it in the story, but I did hear from Mark D'Antonio, who's MUFON's photo analyst and also an SCU member, the organization Robert's going to be talking about. He does feel the shadows are way off. The direction of the sunlight is also not consistent, so he believes they're totally a hoax. But there's some very controversial photos, and I'm glad that Philip put this together, because it's kind of Philip does a good job in trying to get, you know, many angles about these stories, so many different points of view are represented. And so, yeah, people could check that out at openminds.tv to see these kind of latest wild UFOs that are pictures that are making the rounds.
And is it a disc? What type of craft are they?
Well, like I was saying, it's hard to describe. Yeah, I think it's dubious. I thought it was interesting, though, that people like Bruce McAbee think that it might be a legit thing. So,
well, that's
something worth checking out. And yeah. Then the only other story I wanted to mention was, and this is kind of interesting, is this documentary called Love and Saucers explores the sexy alien encounters. So it's a documentary focused on abduction stories that have like a sexual aspect, where people have like had sex or maybe even have fallen in love with, you know, certain creatures, according to them. So that's another story you can find at openminds.tv. It sounds really interesting, and I believe the people who made this movie listens to us. They're listeners. Yeah.
All right. Do I hear noise in your background there?
Yeah, it's people getting ready, because we're supposed to be going somewhere.
All right. Hey, Alejandro, thanks so much.
And, no problem.
Sorry for the glitches tonight. Hopefully that will not happen again.
Yep.
All right. All right. You take care.
You too.
All right. All right. So now our guest is Robert Powell. He was on once before, and he's coming right up. I've got a couple of phone. Hi, I'm looking to speak with Robert.
Who's calling?
This is Martin Willis.
Matt Tickett, Matt Fetch, he's not available right now.
I'm doing a live show with him and cannot get a hold of him. So if he's there, he's wanting to talk to me.
Okay. Hold on just a minute, because I know he was doing something.
Yes.
Hold on just a second.
Thank you. Hi, Robert. Skype is not working on your end?
I just checked, and it looks like my connection has broken, and I'm trying to repair it, okay. Which I don't really understand because my cell phone's got a connection.
Well, it's very strange because it must be the government, that's all I can think of, because my internet totally went out on this end. I had to unplug my router and plug it back in, and it's working fine now, but... very strange, both connections on both ends.
Yeah, but maybe that's what I should try.
Yeah, well, we can just keep going this way if you'd like. Is this phone okay with you, and are you comfortable?
Yeah, this is fine.
All right, and okay. So can you tell the first-time listener a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I live in Austin, Texas. My degree is in chemistry, and I spent most of my career, the last 30 years, in the semiconductor field. I was an engineering manager. I worked on flash memory chips, on microprocessor chips, and I also managed a state-of-the-art chemistry laboratory, as well as a state-of-the-art research and development laboratory. I retired early, when I was in my 50s, and I went ahead and started doing the things I really enjoyed doing, one of which was to investigate the UFO phenomenon. So I've spent the last 10 years actually probably putting in 15 to 20 hours a week on that, just like it was a job.
Wow.
And I became the director of research at MUFON and done a lot of interesting investigations in addition to talk to personally interviewing probably over 150 people. I did the Steubenville lights investigation back in 2008, and then recently I did a detailed investigation on Aguadilla, which was an IR video that occurred in Puerto Rico.
Right. I thought we could talk a little bit about that as well. You know, along with this new group that you have started. But that one in particular, was there ever any consensus about what that, I know people were saying it was a balloon, you know, you heard everything, but was there ever any consensus of what that may end up being, or is that still an unknown?
It's still an unknown. You know, people have advanced various theories, right, such as a balloon. I think the better theory would be some type of advanced drone, but there's a few problems with that theory.
Right, when it goes into the water.
Pardon?
When it goes into the water, that's a little tough for a drone these days.
Right, but what really makes it difficult is for a drone to come out of the water at high speed. We researched that, and there are some drones that can enter the water and move through the water at a good speed.
Right, but from they can't. Can they do that right from the air, or do they have?
Yeah.
Is it really? Isn't that?
Yeah,
something?
Boeing actually has developed a drone, flies like an airplane, and then it blows its wings off right before it impacts the water, and then it goes into the water like a torpedo, and it maintains fairly high velocity underwater. The problem is, though, that drone can't come back out of the water.
Yeah.
And that's what happens on the video, that we looked at. Some people argue that, well, maybe it didn't really go in the water, but they have yet to advance a strong argument as to why this object would not have actually been in the water, but it's just an image issue. Because there are times where the image is crystal clear and disappears and it comes back crystal clear. So that's not indicative of a video system that is at its limit of capabilities, and then you suddenly lose the object, because then you wouldn't have it come back and, you know, it's a clear object again.
Now, I have taken a look at that video myself, very interesting, and one of the, you know, my first or a thought I had at one time was a balloon, but I understand there was all types of maneuvers where that wouldn't really fit in. And also, the question I have, do I recall that that either splits into two objects, or was that some type of reflection?
No, it splits into two objects. We cannot explain that as a reflection. So there's, you know, so they're all of the debunkers are always trying to come up with some type of theory, right? They never really put out a full report and explain the video from beginning to end, but they try to look at pieces of it. So one theory was, oh, maybe it's a pair of Chinese lanterns that were tied together, and then they tore apart, right, after they disappeared in the water. And then, of course, they have to say, well, they didn't really go in the water in order to make that argument. But probably the biggest problem with a Chinese lantern is that in order to meet the balloon theory requirements, these lanterns would have to move at 20 to 25 miles per hour.
Hmm.
And the problem there is a Chinese lantern won't survive. It speeds much above 5 miles per hour.
You mean it'll just tear apart, basically?
Right. Yeah, they will basically collapse, because all it is a candle that's inside a very lightweight envelope.
Like a paper,
so
yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And it's just pushing hot air to the top, and so that makes it rise. Well, if the wind impacts the side of it and collapses it, well, you no longer are lighter than air, and so then it quickly drops.
Hmm.
So there's no way this could have been, you know, Chinese lanterns.
Now, has anyone...
So no good explanation so far.
Yeah. Has anyone in... You know, I know that there were some people on the team that were looking at this seriously that really wanted to remain anonymous. And those were people of, you know, basic science, if I remember right. Is that true?
The guys who wrote the report, it's myself. I have a science background.
Mm-hmm.
Carl, and I can't recall Carl's last name all of a sudden. Carl Paulson. And Carl's back degrees in physics. He got his physics degree at New York University, and then he worked at Princeton Laboratories. He worked for Lockheed. Very intelligent guy. So he was a key person in the analysis. And then a guy by the name of Larry Cates, who is his degrees in mathematics, and he did a lot of the statistical work on it, as well as, you know, just a lot of the calculations. And then Morgan Beal, whose background is in earth sciences, and then, of course, Richard Hoffman, who works at the Army Materiel Command, and he's an engineer there. Those were the main guys that worked on it. We also had, as soon as we released the report, we had I guess what you might call an IR technician contact us, because he worked on those exact same video systems. This was the MX-15, and he worked on them in Puerto Rico. He said he may have worked on the exact unit that took the photo. He doesn't know, but he was very familiar with them, and he showed these videos to the other technicians in their lab, and they said, you know, they couldn't identify what it was.
Yep.
Their comment was, what was so unique to them was that the object was so easy to see. That was, to them, what was unique about it.
I see. Now, can you remind me, because it's just been a while since I looked at this, was there actually radar data as well?
Yes. We obtained radar data from the FAA. And the radar data does not pick up the object as the plane is videoing it. What the radar data did pick up, though, is it detected an unknown object in the same area that this object came towards Puerto Rico from just northwest of the island, about 2 miles offshore. So radar picks up an unusual object approaching Puerto Rico. And what was unusual also was that the radar was basically scanning every 10 seconds. And so instead of seeing an object that's moving in a straight line, there was an object without a transponder, right? So that means it's primary radar. And it's just jumping around. It's moving in a general direction. And I never could figure out, I said, that's just really strange. It just doesn't make any sense why it would do that. I mean, the only thing I could say for certain was there was some unknown in that area, but I could not explain, you know, why this seemingly random movement. And when I say random, it's moving in a direction, but it's hopscotching around as it moves in that direction. And we sent a copy of the report to the French group, Sigma 3AF, which is a group of French scientists that at one time were part of, you know, CNES and their programs. And they brought up a good point, and then I researched it and said, yeah, I guess they've got a good point here. That's very typical of an object that's jamming a radar signal.
Really?
You see the object. Yeah, just and you can jam radar signals in different ways, and the way I suspect this was occurring, and this is just purely a hypothetical guess, right, is that the object may have had a plasma around it, and plasmas will cause a radar beam to skip and jump. So that's just my guess. But that was very interesting that, you know, I mean, what are the odds that we would pick up this unknown object right before this object approaches Puerto Rico?
That's really bizarre.
And the reason we think, that it disappeared off radar, you know, once it came over the island, was I calculated the distance that the radar could still detect the object based on altitude. And once the object would drop below about 400 feet, it would drop below radar. So that was the theory, is that it was probably above 400 feet. It was picked up on radar. Then once it dropped below 400 feet, then you can't see it on radar anymore.
Wow. That is that is quite a case. And it's something, when something like this happens, it just seems to go so far, and then it kind of, I don't know, fades away. Do you feel that way? You know, like people stop talking about it, and there's never a conclusion.
Right. Yeah, that's, that's the problem in ufology, right, is that there's no organization that continually follows all of these together, you know, like a government-type organization.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, you hear, unless you have a spaceship that lands or something hard and concrete that you can grab, people lose interest, and they just jump from one story to the next without really looking at, okay, where are the really important cases versus just, you know, lights in the sky, for example.
Right. And, you know, that I think in general society has changed in that way, and I think it has to do with just all the information coming at us in all different ways all the time. You know?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Like, I monitored this a little bit on YouTube, and on YouTube you can see how long the average person looks at the video.
Yep.
I mean, the average person didn't look at the video for more than, probably 40, I think it was around 40, 45 seconds.
Isn't that amazing?
So most people, they never even saw the object split. They never saw the object go into the water because they turned it off before it ever got there.
Yeah. Yeah, it really really takes something to keep someone's attention, and I do understand that. I mean, I can't even get through my email. It's something. So let's talk. That case is really fascinating to me, and if there's ever any chance there's an update, I'd love to know. I'd love to know about that. Let's talk a little bit about the new organization that it just was founded recently, not too long ago, right? SCU?
That's correct. We created it in August, Scientific Coalition for Ufology, which we just call SCU. And it's done real well. I mean, the basic concept is that we want people with either law enforcement investigative type backgrounds or science backgrounds. And so currently we have 35 members, and of those 35 members, nine members have PhDs, 92% of all the members have college degrees. And then we have a board that kind of reviews the resumes of any individuals interested in joining, and we pretty much, you know, try to avoid bringing in anyone who has kind of a non-scientific view of the phenomenon. So, so we've got within the group, we've got like a PhD in oceanography, a PhD in physics, PhD in psychology, and then we've got master's and bachelor's degrees in electrical engineering, chemistry, physics, all of the major sciences, PhD in biochemistry. So that tells you that there's a lot of scientists who are interested in this phenomenon if it's investigated in a serious manner.
Mm-hmm. And that is your attempt. That is your mission statement, is investigating
right.
These. Now, so who decides the cases that you're going to choose to investigate?
The way we're currently set up, we actually have not gotten to the point yet of investigating a specific case, other than the Aguadilla, Puerto Rico case, right, which was the very first case that we did, but that was before we created the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So now, any time we find a case that looks like it has hard evidence, then we will collect a group of individuals and we will investigate the case. But I would say on average, you only usually have one or two good cases a year. And by a good case, I mean a case that you either have a lot of witnesses or you have some type of strong photograph or video, something that can be analyzed, kind of like the Stephenville case or the Aguadilla case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that you can kind of sink your teeth into it.
Yes, we were talking back when both of our internets were working. We were talking ahead of the show about how elusive, you know, UFOs are, and how, you know, if you're doing scientific research, how difficult it is to do. It's not replicable.
Not like you can sit out someplace and say, okay, I know there will be a UFO show up here today. It's, you know, it's on the schedule. Yeah, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. I think Bob Lazar would argue with you on that one.
Oh, yeah. He would probably say, yeah, there's a place you can go and see them all the time.
Yeah, well, yeah. So now, website address, let's just give that out real quickly.
Yeah, that is it's www.scu.org.
Oh, okay. I think I might have a different website up. I'll have to check that out. So I wish you luck. I hope you
may have it.
Go ahead.
I think you're right. I'm sorry, Martin, you're right. It's explorescu.org.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. Yeah. So let's hope some really good cases. I see you can actually report a case there as well. And also, let's talk quickly about UFO data, because that is another organization you're involved in, and that's got to be, what, 3 years old or 2 years old now?
Yeah, UFO data is 3 years old. I'm not as actively involved in that organization, but I'm part of the organization. Its basic mission is to develop basically an optical system that takes spectra of lights at night so that you can analyze the photo. And the system that's been developed so far actually takes two images. One's an optical image, and then the other is a spectra.
Mm-hmm.
The most difficult part that, you know, the UFO data group has run into is basically the software issues that surround when, you know, how a camera recognizes an object, right, and without being confused by a falling leaf or movements in the clouds, insects that go by, those kind of things. So that's the most difficult part of developing the system.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of algorithm writing to get around all that.
Right.
You know, a lot of development to get something like that going. So let's talk about the Nimitz case, which is another fascinating case. I know people were talking about it before, but the first I heard about it is when Chris Mellon talked about it. How long have you been researching that case in particular?
Well, I actually first found out about this case in July of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting story, because when I found out about it, it wasn't really out there in the UFO world per se. I think there had been something that cropped up in around the year 2007 on a website called Above Top Secret.
Oh yeah.
But that was all. That was all there was, and there wasn't much about the case at that point in time. But in mid-2016, a gentleman that I've known for a number of years, who is not in the mainstream ufology world, but I know that he works with the government, and he has done work for organizations related to UFOs in the government. Now, I was meeting with him, and he was we were talking about the Aguadilla case. And so he said, well, I've got an interesting case that you might want to hear a little bit about. And he had a folder that was a half inch thick on this case. But he wouldn't let me see the folder, but he told me some things about the case. And then he said, but by the way, someone has leaked it to the internet. So if you want to do a little Googling, you won't have any problem finding it. And so that's what I proceeded to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the magazine article by a former Navy colonel. His name's Paco, if I can pronounce his last name correctly, I think it's something like Chikari or something like that. But probably a number of your listeners may have seen this website. So I found the website. So what attracted me to it was it was not a typical UFO website, right? This was actually on a Navy blog. And so I looked at the writer's other blogs, right? And they're all about Navy items. This is his only write-up on a UFO. And he's using Navy lingo through the whole thing. He takes time in the beginning to say, you know, this is pretty crazy, and so I'm going to start off by telling you how strong the witnesses are in terms of their credibility. And so he goes through that. And so as soon as I read that, I said, okay, this is a legitimate case. This is not, you know, just some wild case out there. So I began, the first thing I had to do was go look up all the Navy lingo so that I could understand exactly what these guys were saying happened. And so once I did that, the next step was in late December of 2016, I sent out, I think about 11 FOIAs. I think all total now I've sent out 13 FOIAs. So I sent them out to every different Navy organization to find out information, because it's probably good at this point that I tell your audience kind of what basically happened. So there's a U.S. Naval group out about 70 miles west of San Diego. It's November of 2004. And they had been, the USS Princeton, which is a missile frigate, had one of the top radar systems of that time, which was called a Spy 1 radar system. And they'd been detecting an object, apparently, for several days that would be up at 80,000 feet, and then it would be down to, you know, 50 feet to 100 feet above the ocean floor. And so on this particular day, I'm not sure what motivated them to do this, but the Princeton picks this up, these two objects up, or one, I'm not sure if it's one or two objects, they pick them up on radar, and they call in a Marine F-18. It's a colonel, a Lieutenant Colonel Kurtz, who also happened to be the commanding officer of that, of an entire Marine squadron. So they give him the coordinates, and he's flying to the coordinates. Before he gets there, the Princeton radios him and tells him to break off because they're sending two Navy Super Hornets, which is just, you know, a more advanced F-18, to the target. But since he's in the area, he goes ahead and flies by, and he never sees the targets, but he sees this huge bubbling area in the ocean, which to him, the best explanation is like a ship that has just sunk.
Mm.
Because he says the water is glassy clear that day, except for this one area. So he breaks off and goes from the area, and then the other two F-18s, who the commander of the group, which is called the Black Aces off of the USS Nimitz. The commander's last name is Fravor. He's headed there with his wing guy, and as they approach, they don't see anything on radar, but once they get close enough and get to the target, they see the target that the USS Princeton has vectored them to them. And what they see is basically, he describes it as a tic tac. So it's basically, you know, like those candies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a oval type object. And the commander believes the tic tac is, he said, there's no wings, there's no method of propulsion, it's just there in the sky. And but then it turns its nose towards him. And when he does that, when it does that, he assumes that that's an aggressive move. And so one of the F-18s, I think, changes to a different altitude, and then his F-18 engages the object. Now, he doesn't have any weaponry on board. He's just, I guess, doing his standard maneuvers, which, yeah, I'm not familiar with those, not being in the Navy. But my understanding is what happens is he's trying to do a maneuver so he gets behind the object. And the object actually gets behind him, and so he's never able to do that, and he's, you know, he does various maneuvers, and then finally this object just takes off and leaves. So he and the other F-18, you know, they're not able to match that speed, so they just head back to the Nimitz. As they're heading back to the Nimitz, the USS Princeton calls them and says, you'll never guess, but the object is back at its same cap. And cap just means that's its location where it was first found by the USS Princeton. And so the commander says, well, you know, we're low on fuel now. We cannot, you know, turn back around and go back there. So they proceed to the Nimitz, and the Nimitz sends two more F-18s to that target. And it's at this point, it's not real clear if it was the first two F-18s or the second two F-18s that apparently took a video of the object. But I'm pretty sure it was the second pair of F-18s. And the story of what happens to them, you know, and we don't have, because the guy who wrote the Navy blog was familiar with this Captain Fravar. I mean, not Captain, but the Commander Fravar and Lieutenant Colonel Kurth, who was a commander of the Marine Squadron. So what his story basically is the story from those two officers, and we don't have the story of whoever, you know, the two F-18s that went out later.
Now, when this when they flew over and they saw the bubbling in the water, were they assuming that the thing went underwater? And I heard you say early on that it was down to 100 feet above the ocean floor, so that means they were actually tracking it underwater?
Oh, no. Okay, I'm sorry. 100 feet above the ocean surface.
Oh, the ocean surface. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, just above the ocean surface. Now, in the article that's written, the Marine Colonel doesn't draw any conclusions as to whether something, you know, that this was the object he was going to find or anything. His only conclusion was the ocean water was crystal clear, you know, much more calm than normal, except in this area where it looked like an object the size of a ship had just sunk.
Yeah.
Because of turbulence in that area. But he did not know what caused it, or he didn't see anything that caused that. He only saw the water turbulence.
So do you think at this point that this, I know you did your FOIAs, and we can talk more about that, but at this point, is this case classified as far as you know?
Oh, you mean classified by the military?
Yes.
So far, and all of my FOIAs that have been denied, the Navy has never said that this information is classified, and that's why we can't send it to you. What they've said every time was that they just don't have the logs. And so basically what they've said is five different naval assets, right? The USS Nimitz, the USS Princeton, the Navy Squadron, the Marine F-18, and there was also what's called an E-2 Hawkeye, which is an airborne early warning aircraft that was in the area that also picked up the object on their radar. All five of those Navy assets, when I sent FOIAs, every time the response came back was that we have no information. We don't have those logs. We don't have anything. So they never used they never claimed classification or top secret. However, when I asked for the deck logs of the USS Princeton, I received that same reply that we don't have any deck logs. And a FOIA officer, because you know these FOIA officers that you send these requests to, they're not really in the business of trying to hide information from you. They're just, you know, they're doing their clerical job.
Mm-hmm.
And this FOIA officer did say this to me. He said, that's very unusual that they can't give you the deck logs. And he said that it's so unlikely that they've lost the deck logs that it's more likely that they have classified it. And it's classified high enough that he's not even aware of the classification. So basically he's saying if it's classified, like top secret, for example, he's never, as a FOIA officer, he's never going to know that. All he's just going to hear is, we don't have those logs.
I thought that was kind of against the Freedom of Information Act, but maybe I just don't know enough about that. I thought that So once something hits classified, that it's just pulled out of the loop, and you have to wait until after that changes, say, you know, 25 years later or 50 years later or something?
Right, yeah. If it's classified or if it's secret or if it's top secret, they don't have to give you that information.
In other words, they don't even have to acknowledge that it exists at all.
I'm not sure if they have to acknowledge it exists at all, but I know it is a practice to just say it doesn't exist, does not exist, even though it does.
Hmm.
Because I've done enough FOIAs, I just see that happen. Now, sometimes what I think happens also, Martin, is it's a lot of work for them to go find this information, right?
Hmm.
And in some cases, they just say, hey, you know, I don't want to mess with that. We don't have the data.
Or I've heard replies that we can't find it.
Right.
Which sounds even more suspicious.
That's actually what my appeal was. So, for example, when I appealed one of the FOIAs, the first appeal was just turned down. They just said, nope, we agree, because you're really appealing to the Navy, just to a higher-up. You're appealing to JAG, which is the Navy's basically their legal arm. And so they just said, no, we agree. They've done a reasonable search, and that's all they have to do is a reasonable search. And so then they give you the legal cases that support, you know, what defines the reasonable search. So then I sent back a second appeal on another one of the FOIAs, and I noticed on the email it was the same JAG officers that were going to evaluate that one. So I sent them an additional email where basically I said, I understand your first argument, and there's some validity to that. I said, however, in this case, what I'm arguing is you've got five different Navy assets, right? And you're going to tell me that it's reasonable that you can't find documents on any of five Navy assets that were in a Navy exercise on that day? And so this time, after I sent that to them, they said, well, we'll take that into consideration. So I think they said, okay, we got to throw this guy a bone. So they sent me back a partial acceptance on my appeal. And they sent me some emails back. And I was really surprised that these guys sent me these emails. This email, the first one, and I open it up and I'm looking, and it's from Lieutenant Colonel. And they have sent, the JAG officers have asked him, have you ever heard of this case, blah, 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 right? His response is, oh, the Tic Tacs. Yeah, we know all about the Tic Tacs.
Wow.
And I'm just like, wow, so now they're admitting that this happened. Mm-hmm. And it's just a question of finding the logs. And another lieutenant colonel, this guy was my second guy, he was not a lieutenant colonel, he was a major. And he said, well, we don't have these documents because they're, they're over 10 years old. And so they would be in the archives. And so then he writes in his email, I'm sure you could find a point of contact that could find the documents in the archives for Mr. Powell. And so, of course, I've sent them another appeal that I want them to go search the archives, because I think all they did initially is they just asked the squadrons, hey, do you have these documents from the year 2004? Well, no, they don't have documents. A squadron's not going to keep documents that old. So they never really went and looked in the archives. So that appeal's still outstanding. It's almost 2 months old now.
Hmm. And I know...
Well, my mind,
go ahead.
Martin, no doubt that this happened.
Yeah.
You know, the event happened. My understanding is that there was the Navy Inspector General actually investigated the case, but I can't prove that. That's all hearsay from what I've heard so far.
So now I played up on YouTube. I played the video that it shows online. Is that authentic video? Do you know anything about that?
Okay, so I'm familiar with the video. We don't know for certain that that is the video that was taken by the F-18s. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that the F-18s did take video, because in my FOIA reply, that's noted in the Lieutenant Colonel's email. He said, a lot of us saw the video. So apparently, these guys got the video, and they were playing it among the other, you know, various officers on board the ship. So we know video exists. What I don't know for certain is the video that was released on the Internet. And that video was actually released in 2007 on the Internet. And so various people have made arguments about, maybe it's a fake video because it was released on a German video, media video type site, you know, that makes movies and things. So whether or not that is the video, I can't say for certain. I actually suspect it is a copy of the original video, and the reason I say that is the altitude that's shown on the video, 20,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
is the same altitude approximately that the commanding officer of the F-18 said they were at when they encountered the, what he called the Tic Tacs.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that is, you know, but we don't know for certain. And to me, what's the most important part about this case is not whether that video is the real video or not. To me, the important part of the case is that we've got testimony from Navy and Marine officers that this event happened, and those F-18s were sent off of the Nimitz to intercept this object, and they, and the lead F-18, who was the commanding officer, engaged the object with his aircraft. So, you know, to me, that eliminates just about everything. And my view is, I just want to know, you know, why can't the Navy just tell us what they know? I don't understand their need to hide that information.
Yeah, it's probably up above them. Who knows? So did you actually speak to the witnesses, or was there, you know, was a communication in through email, or how, what happened in that when it comes to the witnesses?
Okay, so the witnesses, I have not been in communication with any of the witnesses. I do know an individual who contacted me and actually made communication with Lieutenant Colonel Kurth. And remember, he was the Marine who was in the first F-18, that all he saw was the water disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so he called Lieutenant Colonel Kurth, and he said that it was a very polite conversation. He said the gentleman spoke very slowly, very distinctly, and, you know, he was very confident in everything he said. And he said that, this is interesting. The first thing he found out was that Lieutenant Colonel Kurth actually worked for Bigelow after he left the service.
Huh.
And, of course, we all know Bigelow's interest in UFOs, right? Now, whether or not that's coincidence or part of the reason he was initially hired, you know, there's no way to know. But in his conversation, the Lieutenant Colonel did say that he could not comment any further on the case because of his prior job agreement, you know, with Bigelow Industries.
Hmm.
So I thought that was interesting.
That is. So what is the protocol for, like, to say you're investigating this case and you see the person's name that wrote that blog and you are actually able to get a connection to contact that person? What is a protocol for doing something like that?
Well, I'm myself, you know, somewhat leery on that, right? Because I just hate intruding on someone's private life. You know, the guy who contacted the colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Kurth, I guess was not as, you know, it wasn't as big an issue for him. And most of these guys, like, for example, the commanding officer of the F-18 that engaged it, who was Commander David Fravor of the Black Aces, which is the name of his Super Hornet group. I was able to determine where he lived, and he had just moved within, I think, a month of when I determined it. And so I sent him a registered letter, certified letter, so it would come back, if it picked up where he had moved to, if he'd done a change of address or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never received the letter back or a reply. And, you know, I just send a real nice, polite letter. A lot of these guys, after they get out of the military, they work in the defense industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the UFO topic is, when I say it's like the great, I love, you know, the quote, the great taboo. It's not like, you know, I don't think it's like someone said, okay, you can't, you know, don't ever talk about UFOs, but it's like if you're in that industry and you do talk about it, it's almost like you're talking about a ghost, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
It's almost like, oh, I saw a ghost this morning. Yeah, I walked right across my living room. I mean, you get the same kind of reaction just about.
I think it's interesting that Bob Bigelow, for one, is not too afraid to talk about it.
No, he's not. Of course, I guess he's the guy that does the hiring, right?
So yeah.
he doesn't have to have any fear about his job. But I think most other, you know, other guys do have concerns about talking about it. That's a lot of the reason why a lot of the times military guys that talk about it, they've been retired and they're in their, you know, 70s or 80s.
Mm-hmm. Right. No one's going to really bother them at this point. So
right.
It's after the hour, and I'm going to put out there that if anyone wants to call in and ask our guest some questions, and you're live watching on YouTube, you'll see the number underneath in the description. It's 603-967-4030. If you'd like to call in and ask our guest a question. So where do you think this particular case, where do you think it's going to go? Do you think some more people will be engaged eventually in talking about the incident?
Yeah, I think there will be more information that comes out on the case. I was talking to Chris Mellon, and, you know, Chris is part of the belongs to the Stars group.
Yeah.
And I've known Chris, I guess, probably 4 years. I have not met him in person. But he's what I consider a, you know, fairly conservative person in terms of his views on the UFO phenomenon. So he's pretty down to earth on it. And he indicated to me that, you know, they would have more. They have more information on this particular case. So it will be interesting to see if he has some, you know, some additional information.
Now, he was in office when this was happening, but I know how compartmentalized everything is. I'm sure he probably never knew anything about it.
Actually, he told me he had heard about it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and. You know, he was, he was confident that it had occurred. He didn't know that at that time when I talked to him about this. I first talked to him about the case, and not too long after I found out in mid-2016.
Mm-hmm.
And he was confident at that point. This is long before, you know, the To the Stars group had been formed.
Right.
And at that point in time, he was confident that this had happened. And he was aware of the FOIAs I was going to be sending out. And, you know, he was supportive of all that. But now, he clearly has gotten some more information within the last 6 months.
All right, everyone. So that's it for the free part of the show. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, if you can't help us out, support us for $2 or more a month, you can always listen to us on the Dark Matter Digital Network, and that's 10 to midnight. That's Eastern Standard Time. So YouTube, you can also watch the full shows there. And to support us for only $2 or more a month, go to podcastufo.com. All that information's there. You can listen to full shows and archives. And next week, we have Peter Davenport coming up. Always a fun guest. So thanks again, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.